This is Roger Goldman. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. Coming up, we're going to be speaking by phone with Carol Rudell. She's the administrator of Live On Utah. We're going to be talking about National 988 Day and suicide prevention. Then we're going to be joined in the studio by Bill Sirocco. He's going to recap last night's city council meeting. And we'll finish our hour by speaking with Nancy Major with the V Foundation. Stay tuned. Let's do a little bit of local news. After a five-year hiatus, the Mountain Metal Amateur Boxing event returns this weekend to Park City's Corner Store and features some local competitors. KPCW's Leslie Thatcher has more.
The event is sponsored by Rise Boxing Gym in Jeremy Ranch. Owner Mary Gwynn, or MG Valinga, says the first medal in 2019 was a successful event, but as with many things, the pandemic put a stop to it until now. This year, 20 fights are on the card, and of the 40 competitors, 8 of them are locals who train at Rise. The event will be outside at the Corner Store patio on the plaza of Park City Mountain Resort. Valinga says tickets are $20 for adults and $10 for kids. VIP tables are also available with 8 chairs for $500.
We're doing this as a charity event, raising money for the Parkinson's Foundation, as well as our own nonprofit. We do scholarships for youth to box at a discounted rate. And then we also have a Parkinson's program. Parkinson's patients benefit from the therapies of boxing. And so that has been a really cool program that we've been doing for about a year and a half.
Boxing is one of the programs offered through the Park City Community Foundation's Youth United Fund to provide reduced-cost activities for children regardless of their financial circumstances. The event is sanctioned by USA Boxing. Amateurs between the ages of 8 and 40 are eligible to compete.
Younger kids compete for 3 one-minute rounds, and as you become an older and more elite fighter, you compete for 3 three-minute rounds. So these fights are quick. They're 10 minutes. We'll move pretty quickly through them. And yeah, it should be pretty action-packed.
Mark Gass joined the gym about a year ago and is looking forward to his first amateur fight.
This was a great way to put myself, a goal, the same way that people that run, may go into a marathon or a triathlon. For me, having this event was a great goal. And it's for a great cause, so, I couldn't think of anything better to prove myself that the training and the consistency and everything we've put into the gym, was a great chance to display all of that.
Boxers are asked to individually fundraise for the cause. Spectators can also choose to donate at the event. Doors open at 5 o'clock Saturday. The bell rings for the first match at 6. Leslie Thatcher, KPCW News.
Summit County says a few fenced-in homes may have enjoyed a tax break because assessors couldn't legally get to them. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports now the county is reassessing.
Owners can appeal their property values each year to change what they owe in taxes. But so can the Summit County Assessor's Office. That's what assessors recently did for 3 properties in the River Ranch subdivision between Peoa and Rockport. The Summit County Council approved an increase of $4.5 million for one property and about $1,300,000 for the others Wednesday.
These homes sit back off the road, posted, gated.
That's Summit County Assessor Stephanie Paul explaining her office doesn't have the right to go beyond property gates to appraise home values. Assessors can enter gated communities and even venture onto private property, but they need the owner's permission to access a fenced property posted with no trespassing or similar signs. The county says that's resulted in lower property taxes for the 3 River Valley Ranch homes in question. Here's Councilmember Chris Robinson.
Now that was sort of news to me too. And it's rare that we see an increase, in the valuations on a stipulation. It was driven by the assessor's office wanting to correct a discrepancy that they viewed was there because of a lack of access.
The assessor's office realized one home was more valuable because it was recently listed for sale. That property saw the $4 million increase.
We've come up with other avenues of trying to get some information, and on these 3 particular homes, found that our system details of the property were completely inadequate. And so we are sending out notice of a corrected valuation on these 3 properties.
The deadline to appeal property values every year is September 15th, but since the River Valley Ranch properties have been reappraised, those owners get another 45 days after receiving their new valuation notices to appeal the Summit County Assessor's updated property findings. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
September 8th is National 988 Day. Here to talk about 988 Day and Suicide Prevention Month is Carol Rudell of Live On Utah, part of the DHHS Office of Substance Use and Mental Health. Good morning, Carol. Thanks for joining us.
Well, good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, Carol, how significant a problem in Utah is suicide?
Suicide deaths certainly affect all of us, and it does appear that we need to pay attention to it, of course, if it's a challenge. And it's something that affects almost everyone in Utah, so we can all do something about it.
And how does Utah compare to other states with respect to suicide rates?
Utah consistently has been above the national average, but we're very similar to our neighboring Rocky Mountain states. So in essence, we're high. However, we're not that uncommon. We do tend to stay in about the top 10% or the top 10 states in terms of those rates.
And how often do we see suicide or suicide attempts by teenagers or young people?
Oh, well, we break down and analyze by all age ranges, and our youth historically and to this day have been between 6 and 7% of all of our deaths. And in fact, in 2023, the number of deaths has decreased just a few. And that's always good news when we hear that about our young people.
And I'm sure there may not be any easy way to categorize the causes of suicide, but I'm sure you have tried to look at that. What can you tell the audience about why we see suicide? What are the typical reasons for it?
Well, certainly, suicide is very complicated, and every person who has taken their own lives has their own background, their own experience, their own complex social and emotional challenges. It's difficult to put your finger on one thing, but certainly we can look at mental health diagnoses of, say, depression or anxiety. And then we can also look at what's happening in someone's life. But I would also say that the events that are happening are probably a tipping point. But we're quick to point out, oh, someone's getting a divorce or someone lost their job. There's probably a lot more going on behind the scenes that we don't know about other than that event in someone's life.
What is the Live On Utah program?
So Live On Utah is a public-private partnership to raise awareness, not just that suicide exists. I think we all know, we all are aware of that, but what can we do about it? It's helping us learn to look for those warning signs, take action, engage with our family and friends that we're concerned about, and help them access resources.
Well, you mentioned the term warning signs, which was actually one of my next questions. What are some of the warning signs that of potential suicide that you would like our listeners to be aware of?
Oh, absolutely. I think the biggest thing we can notice is if something is different or something is off. The reality is sometimes people maybe they've come to work on time or even early every day, but suddenly maybe they're a little late, or maybe it's someone who's always come to church and they're not there for a few weeks, and things are going on that you notice are different. Maybe someone is always engaged and always volunteering their time, and suddenly that's not happening. It's being able to look at those changes in people and noticing them. It's also about listening to what they say. If someone is saying, oh, it doesn't matter if I'm here tomorrow, nobody will care if I'm gone, those kinds of things. It's like we say them kind of as idioms in our lives. But the reality is if that's something you're not used to hearing, that should be a warning sign. We should address that. When we do address a warning sign, it's important to notice or to say that you've noticed something. By doing that, we connect. We acknowledge this person. We value them. They suddenly feel like, what? You notice that something's off with me? And that connection is the best thing we can do.
So that's the first concept, is to try to connect with the person. What other kinds of steps do you suggest listeners consider when dealing with the warning signs?
Well, certainly speaking up. You know, the myth is that if we talk about suicide, we're planting seeds. The reality is someone is either thinking about it or they're not. So making that connection, talking about it, it reduces the stress, actually, and helps someone feel like they can do something about it. And then it's on us to be educated and to say, you can call 988. It's an easy number. Anyone can call 988, by the way. That's our suicide and crisis lifeline number. And that you can get support. You can help someone de-escalate. They can give resources. We need to know as a public that we can do something. And noticing what's happening and then being able to sit with someone and listen and connect them to like 988 or other resources. That's the key to what each of us can do.
So that is a natural segue into talking about National 988 Day. What is that, and what kinds of programs are being run?
So in July of 2022, Congress implemented a one call number, just a three-digit number, not unlike we dial 911 and we know we're going to get fire or ambulance or police to show up. 988 is for that mental health concern, a struggle, a crisis. You call 988, a trained crisis worker answers the phone, listens, triages the situation, helps someone right there on the phone in that moment. From that call, not only do you get those supports, but if someone really needs someone to show up and help them, then in Utah, we can dispatch mobile crisis outreach teams to help people in that moment in the location where they are. We also have receiving centers and access centers where individuals who are struggling and need kind of that in-person support for longer than, say, a few hours, they can go to a receiving center and have a support of a physician, a clinician, and all in that space to address really their physical and emotional needs. Yeah, 988 is great. It's one call, and you can call it whether you are in crisis or whether you're just needing support today or you're concerned about someone else. They have the resources to help.
So when I dial 988, does it go to a Utah number or is it a national call center? How does it work mechanically?
Very good question, and I think that's something we all wonder about, right? Who am I going to get when I call? 988 nationally is set up based on the area code of your phone number. So if you're in Utah and you have an 801-435 or 385 area code on the phone you're calling from, it will go to our local highly trained crisis worker team up at the Huntsman Mental Health Institute. Mm-hmm. If you get on hold, and it does happen, unfortunately, if you're on hold for more than about 2 minutes, it will automatically transfer to another state that can pick up that call. It's still trained crisis people. It's still trained folks who can help someone on the phone. They just may not have those Utah resources. And what I always say is if you're calling or your cell number is Tucson, you know, just say, I'm in Utah and I need support in Utah, and they can make a transfer as well.
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, more and more as people move about, particularly here in Park City, we get some people moving, so many people moving from other jurisdictions. Almost half the people I know have area codes that are not not local. So that's interesting. I guess over time, they'll probably have to come up with a different system that figures out where you are rather than where you're from.
I think that's coming. Of course, that takes money, sure. And Congress would need to appropriate that. But and they may. But I think an interim step of if I call 911 and I'm standing in my driveway, it literally pinpoints me standing in my driveway, right?
Right.
What we're hoping to do is the next step, an interim step to that, would be I call. And if I'm on a cell phone, which most of us use now as our main phone, it will triangulate and say what cell phone tower you are at. And then it will determine it should go to Utah or it should go to Tucson, wherever you are.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's the next step.
Let's talk about other programs that you run during the year to facilitate suicide prevention.
There's a lot happening all year round. Certainly, Live on Utah has within it playbooks. You know, these very questions that you're asking of, oh my gosh, how can I learn these things? We have playbooks that are 5-minute lessons with about 10 lessons each, that a lesson on warning signs, a lesson on who might be at risk, a lesson on how to talk about suicidal, and just 5-minute lessons. And we have them, Live on Utah is our original one. Then we have the Live on Latino playbook, which is in Spanish for our Spanish-speaking friends. And then we have a military playbook that really focuses on service members, veterans, and their families. Those can all be found on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, as well as liveonutah.org website. It's great. 10 short lessons, 5 minutes each. We can do it on our phone when we've got time, right? Easy.
Okay. Where can listeners learn more about suicide prevention if they have questions?
Certainly liveonutah.org. It's got a lot of resources on it. We try to keep it updated on everything that's happening. There are other organizations in our community, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, NAMI Utah, the Statewide Suicide Prevention Committee. All of those organizations have websites, and all of them have the ability to refer you to resources. If I had to say one page that has the most resources is actually UtahSuicidePrevention.org. And there you'll find resources if you're a faith leader, if you are a member of the LGBTQ plus community, if you're an older adult over 65 with your veteran. That website has for the last 15 years accumulated and kept up to date on all resources. So.
Okay, yeah. And anything else you want to touch on before we go?
Everybody can do something. Every single one of us can notice what's happening in the lives of people around us, and we can take action and start conversations. Connecting with people prevents suicide.
Carol, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
We'll be right back after this. KPCW News, time is 8:25. A year after two Wasatch High School students in 2 weeks were critically injured after being hit by cars near the school, no crossing guard will be assigned to Heber's Main Street. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports.
One car hit a teen on Main Street and the other student was injured on 1200 South. After the Main Street crash, crossing guards kept watch during the lunch hour that year. But there's no legal requirement for them to be there. Heber Police Chief Parker Severs says numerous factors determine where crossing guards are stationed.
We're only required to have them for elementary schools. It's optional for other grade levels.
To have a crossing guard on duty at any given spot, at least 10 children must use the crossing. A minimum of 500 cars must use the road every day, and there has to be enough space for cars to stop for the crossing guard. No crossing guard will be assigned if there's a marked crosswalk close by. This school year, crossing guards are stationed near all the district's elementary schools, plus Timpanogos Middle School and Rocky Mountain Middle School. Heber Police removed the Main Street assignment this school year. Summer says it's not typical to have a crossing guard for high school students. Plus, he says crossing guards are usually assigned just for the beginning and end of the school day, not the lunch hour. Summer also says a Main Street crossing guard would be an added liability for the police department.
It's not a required location. And so as soon as we put somebody there, we do incur more liability because if something happens, then, you know, they could blame our crossing guard or whatnot.
He says parents and guardians are responsible for ensuring their children know how to safely cross the street, make sure the pedestrian lights are blinking, look both ways, and wait if something doesn't seem right.
And it's very common for kids to be, oh, I'm a pedestrian, I have the right of way. The problem with that line of thinking is they're always going to lose, right? A car versus a pedestrian, the pedestrian's never going to win that battle. And so they have to be aware of the dangers that are there.
Sever also notes Main Street is a state highway, so the Utah Department of Transportation determines where to install stoplights, crosswalks, and other safety features. When an SUV hit the 14-year-old girl on Main Street at 800 South last fall, UDOT was a day out from finishing the installation of a new crossing signal with flashing lights. And the city fast-tracked a planned traffic light at 1200 South and 500 East after a 14-year-old boy was hit in the crosswalk while the pedestrian lights were flashing. Sever says the obligation is to provide a safe route for pedestrians, not necessarily a convenient route. Wasatch County School District spokesperson Kirsta Albert says the district's elementary schools educate students about walking and biking safely at the start of every school year. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Well, in the studio with me this morning is Bill Sirocco to talk about last night's Park City Council meeting. Bill, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Roger. It's a pleasure to be here. It's funny, 9 months into council, and I still get butterflies in the morning when I'm on my way into KPCW for the council recap.
Well, let's face it, I'm a scary guy. Bill, last night the council discussed the potential for ranked choice voting in the upcoming election. Can you explain a little bit about what was discussed and how the ranked choice voting might work?
Sure, Roger. What I would say is that myself and my colleagues on the council, we're always looking to provide the best experience for the constituents here in Park City. So we're willing to look at anything if there's a potential that it could make the way we deliver government, the way we run government better here in Park City. Ranked choice voting was something that was brought up by a previous council. It's something that we've talked about twice now in council chambers. And I think, you know, one of the difficulties for the current council in terms of considering ranked choice voting is that there's a provision in the state code which has allowed municipalities to use ranked choice voting. That provision sunsets in 2025, and it's not clear whether that will be extended or not. So I think after a fairly robust discussion last night, council decided that, you know, given the likelihood or the chance that ranked choice voting could go away as an option in 2025, we didn't want to create and cause that disruption now and change, you know, something that's so fundamental and basic to our democratic and governmental existence here. But there is a Utah Valley University study that should be coming out imminently that'll give us some more information on ranked choice voting. And I'm looking to that to see if there's a clear and compelling reason for us to, you know, to do something and change the way we vote. Without that, it's going to be hard for me to get there. You know, I want citizens to be fully engaged. I want our campaigns to be civil. But, you know, we have to have a compelling reason to change the way we do things, and I'm still waiting for that.
Sounds like we can break this down into two sort of distinct pieces. One is what I would call a procedural piece, which is if it's going to go away, it makes no sense to spend the money and the time and the education to do it. So I put that in category one. Then there's what I would call a substantive question, which is it a good idea? What are the sort of principal arguments that you've heard both for and against it in terms of what it would do to the election process? I know that, for example, a couple of years ago, we had we had some expensive primaries. We then had to run a whole second election. And the other arguments I've heard is that, so the first argument I've heard is simplification. The second argument I've heard is it tends to bring moderation. Are those the arguments that were played out last night?
Yeah, those are predominantly the reasons why, you know, someone would advocate for ranked choice voting. Right now, most of those are very qualitative. There isn't a lot of hard data that you can look at that says behavior is one way or the other in the elections. And that's partially due to the fact that ranked choice voting is relatively new here. One of the most common pro arguments is that it would bring moderation mm-hmm. to the campaign process. To that point, I would point people to the campaign last year, which is the one that I ran in. We had originally 9 candidates in the field for 3 spots. And I have to say, I mean, in my experience, my 50 plus years, it seemed pretty civil. And it seemed pretty much the way you would hope that a local election would go. Our politics here in Park City for council is nonpartisan. So I think, you know, we're motivated by different, but, you know, in a different way around policy, around issues. And one of my concerns is that, you know, if we put a system in place that, pushes people to run a popularity contest, that we lose a little bit of the policy discussion. We lose the ability for candidates to want to feel brave and talk boldly about new policy. And so that's one of my concerns.
So where things stand is, until we hear from the Utah Valley study, it's basically on hold.
Yeah, for now. We're waiting to get, to be more educated on it. And then there's the timing issue. We do have till May 1st, if we were to change, to notify the lieutenant governor. But the issue with that, Roger, is the state legislature, that session doesn't end till the end of February. So that would leave us 2 months before the deadline. And it feels like that might be a little bit rushed to push something through and change the way we do things.
And mechanically, are the other localities, I know other localities in Utah have done this, mechanically, some people say that it's very complicated to do multiple sort of counts, if you will, or runs. But is it something that can be done pretty easily by just simple programming, or is it more complicated than that?
Yeah.
Somewhere in the middle.
Roger, I'm sorry. My teenager is now off to college, so my tech support is not handy. So I couldn't really answer that question.
Okay. I know that the council, anything else on ranked choice voting?
No, I think that's it for now.
I know the council previously moved to delay granting some $2 million in fee waivers to the developers of Studio Crossing. That's the housing complex that's going up next to the film studio. Was that discussed again last night?
Yes, that was discussed again last night. And I think the main what we uncovered last night is that there's a timing issue. For a developer of any project to apply for a fee waiver, that doesn't happen until the building permit process, which is like the final piece of the years-long approval process. And that took some of the council members by surprise that they were coming in for the fee waiver. Now, that being said, Studio Crossing is a project that's going to provide, I think the number was 207 affordable units, workforce affordable units here in Park City, which is something that, as we all know, is hard to come by. And, you know, the current council, as well as previous councils, are committed to providing and incentivizing more workforce housing. So that really was the crux of the issue last night. Now, $2 million is a lot of money. It's not a city project. It's a private project. So we need to think about, you know, where we're spending city money. We need to think about how we incentivize private developers to step in and help us with that affordable housing problem. That's part of that conversation.
So the, you know, aged economics major in me has some questions about about how we do this. It is certainly appropriate for the council, in my view, to consider, you know, incentivizing affordable housing. But as I understand it, there were some concessions on the density side made up front with respect to this project. It would seem to me that if you, from a policy perspective, you would want to know the entire package of incentives you were exchanging for the construction of affordable housing at the outset of the project. Because right now, I mean, one could say cynically, well, look, these Studio Crossing guys, they're committed. They're going to build this thing whether you give them a break or not. You're going to get the housing whether you give them a break or not. Why should you give them the break? And how do we set up a better system?
Yeah, that was something that I learned last night, that the fee waiver doesn't come until the end, well after everything's been negotiated. And to me, I view that as part of the give and take around public benefit, right? What is the city getting for what we're giving or what we're giving up? So I'd like to see us do some work internally on that policy and see where we could tweak that and make that process a little bit more clear, so that we don't run into this issue again. Yeah. That being said, I think it would be important. Like, I think we all understand that the Crandalls are longtime community members. They've done a number of magnificent projects here in town. Kimmel Junction, they've done a great job. And, you know, we want to see them move forward. We want to see them be able to do this project and be successful, because that means they'll be doing another one after that, right? And I think the math is, when it's all said and done, we were talking about $9,000 per unit to make this happen, right, to issue the fee waiver and have them move forward with the project. If you put that in the context of other affordable housing projects around town that the city has incentivized, Engine House, which is a, you know, city public-private partnership, that costs the city at least $100,000 a unit. So I think there's some room that we can figure out a way to move forward and incentivize the Crandalls to build a fantastic project.
So one answer is that the benefit the city might get with respect to this particular decision is really related to the signal you're sending to developers that you're going to be fair. Have I got that basically right?
Yeah, I think Councilman Rubel kind of highlighted this last night. It's really a policy statement. Yeah. And, I, for one, and I've said this last year when I campaigned, I'm committed to providing a better workforce housing experience here in Park City. It's critical. We need more units. You talk to any business owner in town, and retaining and bringing in new employees is the most difficult task that they have. So I'm committed to helping that make that situation better. And I think Studio Crossing is probably going to help that.
Moving away from Studio Crossing in particular, though, is it possible to create a different regime that would allow you to do the benefits versus the upfront? In other words, to not be in this situation. Does the city control the process by which you determine when these kinds of fee waivers happen, and could you move it backward in the process so that everybody knew what the total give and take was going to be?
Yeah, from a policy standpoint, I would say that
Is that possible?
Yeah. I can't speak to whether it's possible, because there's probably some Utah code that we need to consider. So we'd have to defer to our legal team. But from a policy perspective, 100%, I'd like to see us negotiate all the give and take at the same time in the beginning so that we don't, you know, get 2 years down the line and have a developer come in and say, hey, we really need this to make this happen. Now, that being said, I think one of the things that is not known to most folks, to lay people here in town, and the economics major and you, Roger, can appreciate this, the credit environment for new construction loans has been incredibly, incredibly difficult for the past 2-3 years. Interest rates are much higher. Credit availability is much lower. The requirements that banks are putting on developers are much more stringent. So I understand where the Crandalls are coming from. And, you know, given that that's the situation on the ground, I'd like to get to a point where we can help them and make this project successful.
And again, is the sort of potential for an upfront all-in negotiation, is that something that you guys are going to look into whether it can be done?
Well, not in relation to this.
Not in relation to the project. No.
Right,
we're off this project. This project's done.
Moving forward, yes. It's 8:30 in the morning, and we had a council meeting till almost 10 o'clock last night. But, I do plan on communicating to staff that I would like to see some work done on that to see if we can make that process a little bit better, streamlined, and front-loaded so that when we sit down to have a negotiation, we're negotiating everything.
Okay. Bill, you recently traveled to Europe and
yes.
observed how some other cities have addressed transportation challenges. Can you share a little bit about some of the highlights of what you learned and how they might apply to us?
Absolutely, Roger. So back in July, as most everyone knows, there was a IOC meeting in Paris on July 24th, which the result was Salt Lake City was named the host of the 2034 Winter Olympics, which is a huge coup for the state, for the region, for our city. I think, you know, it was one of my most proud moments of being a Utah now for 4+ years. Prior to my time in Paris, I spent a week in Switzerland, and I've been to Switzerland a couple times before, but I went on this trip specifically to utilize the different transportation networks in the country. And I'll tell you, Roger, even though I'd been there before, I did have a number of new takeaways, and I think the most important takeaway was I flew from Salt Lake to Paris. I intended to take a train from Paris to Zurich. 9:30 in the morning, all trains for the rest of the day were sold out till 11:30 at night. So I ended up having to hop a flight from Paris to Zurich. Because it's a short flight, the plane, you don't get super high, so I had a window seat, and I'm looking out at the countryside between Paris and Zurich. And what you notice is that each place, each town, each village, each small city is its own discrete and separate place. That once the civilization ended, once the town ended, it became farmland and forest immediately. And it was farmland and forest until 10, 15 miles down the river, down the train line, down the road, where the next village began. And I would contrast that to, you know, if you go to the Wasatch Front in Utah, and you travel from Ogden to Spanish Fork, right, south of Provo, if you don't know any of the place names, you would not know when you enter one place and leave another. And that was a huge difference. And that was an eye-opening moment for me because, you know, when we talk about investment in transportation infrastructure in the state, I think there's often a tug of war between the more urban and the more rural parts of the state. And the more rural parts of the states are wary because, you know, we're spending all this money for the people that live in the quote unquote big city. But I think what's important for that rural part of the state to understand is that transportation infrastructure is a way to protect their way of life, right? With a less car-centric focus, we get less sprawl. And if we get less sprawl, communities can remain and keep their specific identity and not be overrun by that sprawl and connected, you know, every foot with buildings and strip malls and shopping centers and whatnot. So I think that was a critical takeaway. And then I think the next biggest takeaway in the Jungfrau region of Switzerland, so near Interlaken, there's three towns. There's Grindelwald, there's Lauterbrunnen, and there's Wengen. In Grindelwald, you can take either a train from 4,000 feet of elevation up to 12,000 feet of elevation. Or you can take the new Eiger Express gondola, which is similar to what is being proposed to say in Little Cottonwood Canyon, which actually reduces the trip up because it's a lot faster than the train. And then after you get off the gondola, you take a train for the last one third of the way up to the summit at 12,000 feet, where they have a store, a summit house, an observation deck, all these things. And I asked when I was there, how many visitors a year use this? And I was told that 1 million people a year do that trip. And that trip is not inexpensive. Right. It costs about, I think the least expensive you could do it is about 100 Swiss francs. And at a million visitors a year, I said, my God, people are willing to pay for a unique experience that moves them around. So that was another big takeaway. I spent a week there, traveled to Zermatt, which is a car-free resort city in southern Switzerland, 3 million visitors a year. Main Street is 100% pedestrian, full of people from 8 in the morning till 10, 11 at night, every night of the week. So it was refreshing to see the way things work there, and I'm hopeful that we can maybe lean into that here in Utah. Ironically, one of the largest train manufacturers in the world is Stadler, which is a Swiss company whose U.S. headquarters is in Salt Lake City, and also one of the two major ski lift manufacturers in the world, Doppelmayr, which is Austrian but has a Swiss subsidiary, is also located in Salt Lake City. So I'm hoping we can lean into the Swiss to learn some things about transportation and see what we could do differently here in the future.
So as you take that inspiration, what kinds of things might you visualize, again, very high level, very conceptual, that we might consider doing here?
Yeah, look, I think philosophically, we need to think about the number of visitors we have. We need to think about the number of workforce that need to commute into Park City, travel into Park City on a daily basis. And we need to think about, is there a better way that we can do that? And what are the collateral effects of that? So if we're able to gather that massive workforce, and get them out of their cars on the periphery of Park City and get them into Park City quickly, and we can probably do that faster than they can drive in with traffic, right? Yeah,
particularly today when the car fire in at McPolin is still creating some substantial backup on 248. We're sorry. We hope it clears up soon. Just had to get that public service announcement in there, Bill. Go ahead.
No, absolutely. Same thing on, I think it was Thursday or Friday last week. There was an incident on 224 and heading out of town. 3 o'clock in the afternoon, traffic was backed up from Kimball Junction all the way to the canyons, which is substantial. So, look, if we can think about, and this isn't either or, this is yes and, right? This is, you know, we can have cars, but if we begin to focus on a little less car-centric planning, so the way we develop our community, the way we think about road networks, the way we prioritize walking and biking, and you know, like this is the time of year where you want to be on your bike just about all day long. It's just tremendously gorgeous out. You know, we have an opportunity to, in some respects, be revolutionary here in the United States and be a trailblazer. And I'm just really excited that, you know, with the Olympics coming in 2034, it's going to force us to think about these things. And I'm hopeful that we can decide to, you know, maybe take some action.
You know, big projects take time and vision. It's really hard, you know, for people to sort of say, look, I want to do something that really the fruits of which are not going to be realized for years. But that's what great leadership does. I mean, you look back at, you know, the interstate highway system and the visualization in the late 50s. We now have an interesting, I wouldn't call it an action-forcing event, but an action-concentrating event, which is the Olympics. And the idea that we can do things to try to maximize that is pretty exciting. Bill, this is something I know that is very close to your heart. What kinds of steps do you want to take next to try to push these things forward?
Oh, God, Roger, that's a incredibly deep and difficult question to answer. Look, There are, and I'm, the way I think about it is it's a chess game. Mm-hmm. And right now, like, we need to start positioning our chess pieces on the board so that we can play that game. I think we've seen other places in the state. I know Salt Lake City has been very forward-thinking and has been out in front in terms of talking about the things that they would like to do and want to do with the Olympics coming. I think we need to start having that conversation in a more robust way here. And we can't be afraid to have some big ideas. The bid committee, which is now transitioning into the host committee, Fraser Bullock has asked us several times, Colin Hilton has asked us several times, what do you want? What is your big idea? How can we help you? I think we need to answer that question with something that's big and bold and brave. You don't get anything if you don't ask for anything.
And I assume that's a conversation that needs to happen in the next year or so to get it done.
Yeah, ideally before next summer.
Yeah, Bill, we'll be talking about this more in days to come, I am sure. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
We'll be right back after this. Since 1993, the V Foundation has been a leader in funding cancer research. Here to tell us more about the work of the foundation and about an upcoming fundraiser is board member, and I lost my name. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Okay. This is Nancy Major. I apologize for stumbling over your name. Nancy, can you share a bit about the foundation and how it carries out its mission?
Sure. Again, thank you for having me. The V Foundation started, as you mentioned, with the famed basketball coach Jim Balvano when he gave his SP speech and partnered with ESPN to create a foundation that provides grant funding for researchers who are doing cutting-edge research in the fields of cancer, sort of not afraid to think big and do some exciting research. So 100% of every dollar raised goes directly out to these talented researchers who are identified by a very competitive process.
So just to give our listeners a little bit more of a visualization of how this works, can you give us some examples of the kinds of projects that have been funded?
Yeah, so in fact, right at Huntsman, there's nuances and various ways of looking at, and we fund all types of cancer research, so not specific to breast or prostate or ovarian, for example. And through their unique ideas and advanced research techniques, they'll present their research to their head of their scientific advisory committee within the National Cancer Institute. And then those grants get competitive with other grants around the country. And then our scientific advisory committee at the V Foundation, which is comprised of leading researchers and physicians around the country, screen these, grade the research projects as if it were an NIH grant. And then through that very careful screening process, we'll fund the grant. So we have everything from work being done in genetics to immunotherapy to transitional research, which means that it's being applied to patients. So it's very exciting, and we are very excited about the fact that we've funded over 1,200 grantees. That has resulted in 90,000 publications.
Wow. So Nancy, what drew you to the foundation, and how long have you been involved with it?
I have been involved with the foundation for about 20 years now. I was originally invited to attend my first fundraiser by Coach Krzyzewski, the retired Duke men's basketball coach, while I was on faculty at Duke, and was hooked ever since. And I've been a board member now for 2.5 years.
Okay. And so, wow, it seems like the foundation does have this really interesting interrelationship with basketball. Now, you mentioned that the foundation has funded some projects here in Utah. So there have been projects funded at Huntsman, for example?
Yes, there have. We have granted, I believe it's over $3 million to Huntsman for cancer research.
Okay, so the money has to come from somewhere. Let's talk a little bit about how the foundation raises money generally.
So there's a lot of the money is raised through grassroots foundation. And then so that's people giving because they want to give to cancer research. And then we do some signature events throughout the year that raises a lot more money. And we are getting corporate support. Last summer, we joined with the NHL and the NHLPA. So their Hockey Fights Cancer platform joined with the V Foundation. So collectively, we're raising more money through that. So and with corporate sponsoring, we raise money. So the important thing is that if you give a dollar, that dollar is going directly to research. So 100% of what you give goes directly to the V Foundation.
Just so our listeners can understand that, is there some kind of an endowment that supports the administrative functions of the foundation? Is that because obviously it takes money to run the foundation. How does that work?
Yes, there is an endowment. We are fully endowed, and the endowment is looking strong, and that's what allows dollar for dollar to go directly to research.
And is the foundation still involved with a basketball tournament at Madison Square Garden, which I think has been going on for some years?
Right. So that's the week. That takes place in the beginning of December. And there are two games that are played at Madison Square Garden on Tuesday night. Sort of kicks off that week, and we do a big fundraiser that week.
I've been there. It's a great event. Okay.
Speaking
of fundraisers, I understand we got one coming up here in Park City.
We do. We do. As a new Parkite, if you will, I wanted to gain some enthusiasm for making more and more folks aware of the good work that the V Foundation is doing. And everybody, as Jim Valvano said, is touched by cancer. So, and I wanted to let folks know that we are giving great money out to these talented researchers who are doing amazing work. And we have a lot of very generous people in Park City and a lot of very sophisticated people in Park City who would understand a return on investment. So if I may give you a statistic, we at the end of 2024 will have granted over $400 million in cancer research. And that translates to $19.5 billion that has been given to those grantees. So what that means is we've identified these fabulous researchers, and they've created publications, and then they've applied for additional grant funding, say from the NIH or American Cancer Society, and then they get additional funding. So granting begets granting. And the V Foundation starts that off with being able to allow these talented researchers to test their hypothesis.
Nancy, I hate to interrupt you. We're just about out of time. Can you quickly give us the details of the fundraiser and what website can people go to learn more?
Sure. So they can go to v.org and learn more about the V Foundation. The event is at Glen Wild on Thursday night, September 12th. At 6 p.m. And if anybody wants to contact me directly, it's nancy.major1@gmail.com. Love to see you there. And I really appreciate you having me this morning, Roger.
Thanks, Nancy.